lightly, at other times with a constitutionally unsound sledgehammer. Word got back to me that one young trooper in the zone was told by an overzealous investigator that the next time you see Hackworth will be at his court-martial. In another case, a proven warrior and friend of mine, called in to testify on the events of the Battle of Mi Phuoc Thai, was told off the record before his interview that if he said anything negative about any other participants in the battle, he could very well be sued for slander. In yet another case, the IG handed team member Major Steve Yedinak a sealed letter addressed to Yedinak from me, which had been intercepted by the IG, and asked him to open it and reveal to the IG whether the contents were personal in nature. The Major, a bright, honest, and dedicated officer, wrote in a memo for record of the incident, "I seriously questioned the authority of the IG to exploit the contents of a personal letter. I asked what my alternatives were. The reply, authoritative in nature and tone, was, 'You don't have any alternatives. That's a direct order.' But all the pressure had the desired effect. It was like the one loose thread that once pulled unravels the whole rug. People panicked, and one by one the irregularities, many of which the guys hadn't even known were irregular, came out. Their boss, whom they'd loved and respected, had left in his wake unanswered and unanswerable questions, which they were now stuck with. 'Do you know of any criminal activities on the part of Colonel Hackworth? Do you have any information on Colonel Hackworth's gambling activities? Was Colonel Hackworth a good poker player and a consistent winner? Were you ever approached by Colonel Hackworth to send dollar instruments out of Vietnam? Did Jenny Bates stay in Colonel Hackworth's quarters when she came to visit? Do you know what the sleeping arrangements were? Did Colonel Hackworth use the steam bath? Have you ever seen Colonel Hackworth smoke marijuana?' Then there were the personal questions, asked of virtually every team member, officer, and EM of every grade under oath. 'Have you ever used the Team 50 steam bath? Have you ever engaged in any sexual activities at the steam bath? Have you ever smoked marijuana? Did you ever smoke marijuana during your time in this command?' Confusion bred resentment, even among some of the most loyal of my friends. The few real malcontents eagerly seized the opportunity to get Hackworth. One captain, for example, who hated me ever since I refused him permission to marry a Viet girl he'd fallen for because her background check turned up mighty shady, happily passed on the extraordinary word that he'd heard I was involved in a white slavery prostitution ring in Saigon. And as if that were not enough to send the IGs leaping with joy over the grave they thought they were digging for me, they actually went to a remote acquaintance of mine whose girlfriend had recently shot him 3 times with a .45 when she found him in bed with another woman and suggested to him he'd been shot because he was not buying booze from the Hackworth Mafia for a Tudor Street bar he had an interest in. From what I could gather, the investigator's determination to nail me for smoking marijuana was based on the statement of a PFC who said he'd seen me smoking a joint with several other officers and senior NCOs in front of the officers' club late the night of my going-away party in the zone. What he saw was what he saw, but without any perspective. I was on my way out of the officers' club on my way back to my quarters when I ran into the smokers that night. Marijuana was something I'd accommodated myself to in the zone. It was to these late-60s draftees what booze was to the old regulars, and though I did not smoke it myself, nor had I ever throughout my career, as long as those who indulged did so in their off-hours and did not jeopardize their own safety or the safety of the team, I felt comfortable looking the other way. And if it kept the men who were smoking it from seeking the hard stuff just outside the compound gates, it had its place. I was also absolutely knee-knocking drunk at the time, and when that joint was passed to me, I probably would have taken it if it had been cow dung. So I had a few puffs, said goodbye to the guys, and lurched over to my quarters where I promptly threw up. While the team in Khao Lan was being raked over the coals, back in Seattle, Army agents conducted a 24-hour-a-day stakeout of the Grattan residence. The CID guys went to see Tim at his office and questioned Darlene in the yard. The two Grattan kids, Lisa and Brad, were well rehearsed in what to say if they were approached going to or from elementary school, and for all of them it was the same drill. "Yeah, we know Hack. Last we heard from him, he was in Australia." In fact, Jenny and I were living in the basement apartment of their house. It was an incredible burden to put on my friends, For Tim, who could tell no one I was there, his business associates, whom I'd met in simpler times, were real establishment types who'd been outraged by the Issues and Answers interview, considered me a traitor, and according to Tim, would only too gladly have broadcast my presence to the authorities. And for Darlene, who was, after all, only a war buddy by marriage, and in truth was only barely getting over thinking of me as the enemy from the Germany days when the wives came in a poor last. Fortunately, just as it was all becoming too much, Tim organized a little cabin in the woods for Jenny and me near Spokane, which we slipped up to and stayed in for a couple of weeks before we began what I hoped would be a leisurely drive across America. That had been the plan all along, to show Jenny the sights of the USA until my terminal leave ended, and then to head for Europe to start a new life. While we were at the cabin back in Seattle, Grattan continued to process the information coming in from my personal underground, guys in the zone and others who were on my side at Fort Lewis and other Army installations across the country as well as the Pentagon, and at prearranged times passed the latest on to me from a payphone near his house to a payphone near our hideout. The word was never good, and it only got worse. A couple of my closer zone cohorts were recalled to Vietnam for interrogation, and then Hancock, for reasons I would never know, gave blow-by-blow accounts during his interview of every possible indiscretion I and every friend of mine besides him in the zone had ever committed, pausing only to exaggerate each tenfold. Simultaneously, he portrayed himself as the embodiment of regular Army purity and honor, sullied only by his association with me. He even told the IG he hadn't seen me since we'd flown home from Vietnam together, when in fact we'd met in San Francisco just days before he met the IG. When I briefed him on all zone intelligence I'd collected to that time, he was preparing to return to Vietnam to finish his tour, and we knew he would no doubt face the interrogators. I was flabbergasted by Hancock's treachery and very, very hurt. But then I realized how typical this behavior really was, and how much of it was, in a sense, my fault. Despite all of Hancock's wild trespasses in all the years I'd known him, I'd remained blind to the exceptional weakness of his character. Even his performance during the run-in with the cowboys at John Westmoreland's bar had not wised me up, and by never recognizing his weakness and reining him in, I'd encouraged him in all his games and gimmicks, if only sometimes through benign neglect. So it really shouldn't have been any wonder that when it came to standing in the door, Hancock would only do it for himself. But that didn't make me feel any better. It was bad enough that his bogus testimony opened a whole new can of worms for the IG to chomp on. But what really got me was that I, who prided myself so much as a judge of character, had been so wrong about this human being. Before I left Khao Lan, I'd worked out the itinerary for Jenny's and my trip across the United States. I'd had it typed up, and I'd given it to a number of guys on the team. Just as we were about to take off on that journey, one of my informants suggested that in all likelihood our schedule had been compromised. We decided to go anyway, as planned, except that we left a few days early, bypassed my hometown, and from time to time juggled the stops in order to stay a few jumps ahead of the Army's posse. From Las Vegas, I called Ward just to tell him I thought I was going to need some help, but had so far managed to avoid detection. Ward said, "Hack, you can't out-G the whole goddamn Army," and told me to make my way to Washington, D.C. He had a friend there, a lawyer named Joe Califano, who he thought would be able to help. For the next month, Army agents were on our trail, but always a few days behind. In a pattern that was repeated again and again, we'd leave one location only to have our host there called or visited by the agents a couple of days later. For me, visiting and introducing Jenny to old friends like Terry Toller, Raphael Benjamin, and Doc Holly was a wonderful thing. But all the warm, safe havens these friends provided were just momentary relief in what was the most difficult time I'd ever had. Every bit of information I received, I analyzed 1,000 different ways. Despite some very heavy drinking, by the end, almost a fifth of good old Kentucky bourbon every night, my predicament was the last thing on my mind as I went to sleep, the only thing I dreamed about at night, and the first thing I thought of when I woke up. Meanwhile, I was not exactly the knight in shining armor for whom Jenny had given up her home and career in Australia. I confided nothing in her, and all she really knew throughout was that I was in trouble. It actually made me feel guilty that no matter how distracted or secretive I was, or how many times I went out to make my phone calls or into the bathroom to read my mail, she remained unwavering in her support. Unquestionably, Jennifer Bates was my anchor during a terrible, terrible period, and she was a good woman, too. Finally, we arrived in Washington, D.C. On the outskirts of the city, I called Ward from a telephone booth, and he gave me Califano's number. I called the lawyer's office immediately and made an appointment for 2 days down the track. I would have preferred it sooner, but Califano was still very much a rising star in law and politics and a damn busy man. Still, he sounded so confident and unconcerned on the phone as he said, "Lay low until then. We'll surface you after we talk." That for the first time I thought, maybe things weren't going to be so bad after all. That overconfident feeling proved to be my downfall. We picked a motel in the very shadow of the Pentagon and got settled in. Later that evening, I decided to call Team 50 member Jack Howitt, who was now out of the Army and going to law school in Pennsylvania, on the motel room phone. Without thinking, I violated the cardinal rule when you're on the lam about using only payphones, and sure enough, early the following morning, knock, 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 two CID agents appeared at our motel room door. In the land of the free and the home of the brave, the Army had monitored Jack Howitt's phone and traced me down. "Your leave has been canceled, your records are flagged, and your application for retirement has been disapproved," one of the agents said sternly, and after directing me to contact Major General Alexander Bowling Jr., the CG of Fort Lewis, soonest, they both went away. When I called Lewis, I was told to report back there immediately. "Why?" I asked. "Because you're going back to Vietnam. General Abrams wants to talk to you," Bowling said. "He does not want to talk to me. The IG told me he was so pissed off at me that he never wants to talk to me. Besides, I just drove the whole damn way across the country from Fort Lewis. I'll be damned if you think I'm going to drive the whole way back." "All right, Colonel. Stand by, and I'll get back to you." A short time later, the phone rang. This time, it was a major general from the Pentagon who, I later found, was particularly interested in seeing me hang. "You are to report to Fort Lewis, Hackworth." "No, sir, I will not," I replied. "I just got here. Also, I'm not feeling too good." The words just popped out of my mouth. "All 8 Purple Hearts are hurting." "Fine," the general said in a flash. "Report to Walter Reed Hospital. You'll be assigned there." Great. I called Califano immediately and told him what had transpired. He was not impressed with the phone interception business and assured me he'd have it and any other surveillance stopped. Then I gave him the good news that I'd swung it so I could go to Walter Reed. "For God's sake, man," he exploded. "You don't want to go there. They'll give you a frontal lobotomy." His reaction was so immediate and so impassioned that for a second my blood ran cold. This was serious shit. "Call him back," he continued. "Tell him you're feeling fine. You don't want to go to Walter Reed, and he should assign you somewhere else. And as for going to Vietnam, tell them I'm your counsel, and I have said to you that if you go to Vietnam, you'll be taking me with you." I called the Major General. He accepted Califano's judgment and told me I would be assigned to Fort Meade in a few days. It was a convenient choice if they were determined to have my head. Meade was Court Martial Center, USA, and with the Henderson and Medina My Lai massacre trials happening there even as we spoke, the wheels of the Army judicial system were already greased and rolling. Meanwhile, I was to sign in at Fort Myer, which would officially cancel my terminal leave. As Jenny and I walked through the motel lobby on our way out that morning, the motel operator stole over to tell me to be careful whom I called from the room. An agent was monitoring my phone, he said. I wasn't surprised, but I knew Califano would put an end to that, too. Then, as we walked out of the motel, I saw 2 men, one of whom had been to my room, sitting in an old green Army sedan in the parking lot. When I started my car, they started theirs. but their ancient Ford was no match for my 1971 Olds Cutlass, and after they pulled out onto the street behind me, I just screeched out into the traffic, leaving them for dust. Due to traffic conditions, a CID wrap-up of the exciting day that followed would relate, contact with Colonel Hackworth was broken. When we returned to the motel later in the day, from down the block I could see the same army green sedan now sitting in front of the building. I turned around, circled the block, and, undetected, pulled into a gas station just across the street. I went to the payphone and called the motel operator. "Hello, this is Colonel Swift from the Pentagon," I said in my most efficient voice. "Is my man still there monitoring the phone calls of your guest Hackworth?"
"Yes, sir," said the cheerful telephone operator. "Would you like to talk to him?"
"Thank you," I replied. Immediately, the agent came on the line.
"Scott," I began, "are you monitoring Hackworth's phone?"
The agent replied affirmatively.
"Good," I said. "Now I want you to look out the front window of the motel. Do you see the fellow in the phone booth at the gas station?"
"Yes, sir," the agent replied.
"What's he doing?"
"He's looking at the motel and smiling and waving at me."
"Right," I said. "And do you know who that is?"
"That's me, Colonel Hackworth. You're doing a great job there, pal."
I hung up the phone and got back into my car. As Jenny and I tore away down the street, the green sedan pulled out behind us in an old Ford version of Hot Pursuit. It followed us for a while until we both got stopped at a traffic light. There I played the oldest game in the book, one I hadn't played since the mid-50s with my Austin Healey. With the agents in the vehicle behind us, when the light turned green, I pretended my car was stalled out at the intersection. When the light turned yellow, I revved the engine, and when the light turned red, I burned rubber across the intersection, leaving the Ford behind as the cars that now had the right-of-way honked and braked and barely missed wiping my Olds off the map. As the CID wrap-up would so charitably put it, the agent's second attempt at a loose surveillance of my car was also broken due to traffic conditions. What the report didn't say was what I saw in my rearview mirror as we sped away, one of the agents smiling and holding his hand up in a V. For all the fun and games of it, I was now very pissed off. I called the Major General who'd rung me earlier from the Pentagon and told him I wanted the tailing stopped, like now, and if it wasn't, I hoped he was ready to read about it in the papers the following day. He told me to report into Fort Myer, implying that that would be the only way to get these guys off my ass. So I did. Signed in and was back in the Army. The same agent who had tossed me the V earlier in the day was on hand to witness my arrival at Myer. After I signed in, he actually came up to me to say, for what it was worth, that he was sorry and ashamed to have been part of the dragnet. It had been a long day. I parked the car on the street, and as dusk fell, Jenny and I took a walk around Capitol Hill. On our way to the Washington Monument, we backtracked by the car, only to see two dark, long-haired, hippie-like individuals looking at it. We walked on without a word, but our passing didn't go unnoticed. The thugs started following us, talking to each other in Spanish. Jenny was terrified, and I was only slightly less so. They were not, by the book, all-American white-collar army agents. These were very heavy guys. They were agents, however. It registered in my brain that I'd seen them earlier, near or in an army green sedan, and I thought then how unlikely they seemed to have been part of the army establishment. Still, it wasn't a simple case of me turning around and saying, "Look, guys, 10% never get the word, so maybe you didn't hear they've called off the dogs." These men appeared to have a mission far less benign than the jokers who'd been on my tail all day. When Jenny and I reached the Washington Monument, we scooted in the entrance as if we were going to take the stairs to the top, but we ducked around a corner instead, and the thugs ran by us. We dashed out again and ran down the street, not stopping until we got to a well-lit hotel from whose lobby I called Joe Califano at home. "I'll have it stopped or I'll have Westmoreland's head," he vowed. "In the meantime, don't go back to your motel. I'll see you tomorrow as scheduled." The tailing did stop the next day and was not resumed. The apartment Jenny and I moved into to wait out my fate, however, the name on the mailbox was Omar Khayyam, which I thought was pretty great and didn't change, was carefully searched on a regular basis.
Besides the bugs that I occasionally found and had to remove from the phone, proof of this came through tiny pieces of wood broken off a matchstick or strands of Jenny's hair, one or the other of which I always placed on top of drawers, suitcases, or files before we left the apartment, and which all too often I'd find on the apartment floor when we returned as telltale signs that our gear had been disturbed. When I reported into Fort Meade, I received an ice-cold reception. Officers I'd known for 20 years wouldn't even give me a nod of recognition.
"Oh, yes, Colonel Hackworth," said the adjutant general officer who signed me in but refused to raise his head and look me in the eyes as I stood before his desk. "You're to report to the Chief of Staff, First Army, just up those stairs." I thought my luck was picking up when I looked at the First Army roster and saw that my new boss was Major General Richard Ciccolella. The Chick, as many of us had called him when, years before, he had taken over from Pat Cassidy as Assistant Division Commander of the 101st, was a good, fair man, a hell of a fighting soldier in his day, and someone I'd always had a lot of time for. But the question now was, did he have time for me? He did. Little did I know that when word came down I was to report to Meade, he had personally made sure I was assigned to his office. We talked for a good while when I reported in. Ciccolella wanted to know what was happening, and I told him about the steam and cream, the snack bar, the gambling, the scrounging, the using recon aircraft to get steaks and movies for the troops, and the compound improvement fund, which made all things possible. "Heck, you haven't done anything that good combat leaders have not been doing for years," Ciccolella said as my litany of trespasses went on. "Maybe your way was a little extreme, but if they court-martialed you, they'd have to court-martial dozens of other commanders for similar violations. You were looking after your troops." As we continued to talk, it was a hell of a relief to know that even if he didn't agree with everything I'd done or had to say, General Ciccolella was on my side. "What are my duties, sir?" I asked him as the conversation wound down. "You're working for me. Relax. Leave your phone number with my secretary and I'll call you when I need you." "Thank you, sir. In the meantime, I'm taking you to lunch," he said. And I soon forgot all my troubles, caught up in the camaraderie of the moment. As the Chick and I walked along, salutes were snapped. "Good afternoon, generals," rang out, and I felt as if I was back in the army I loved. At lunch I was treated as I might have been 3 months before. Suddenly I was a comer again, not the leprous pariah I'd been greeted as a scant hour earlier. It was an amazing transformation, made possible only because I was with the Chick, and I would be forever grateful to General Ciccolella for having the guts to offer up the magic power of his stars to let me come home again, if only for a little while. And besides, the general was right. I looked after my troops. Yes, I broke regulations, but I'd been breaking regulations since I got busted in basic training for letting my recon squad go swimming rather than patrol. But what had Napoleon said? Insubordination may only be the evidence of a strong mind. Yes, I had a slush fund in the zone, and in the months and years that passed, rumors about the size of that fund, how it was acquired, and how much I personally got out of it, which was nothing, would grow to immense proportions. But how different was it from the fund I'd had in Germany, acquired through proceeds of D Company's mobile mess, which we'd rented to other companies when they were in the field, and used to fund an after-hours club where the guys could go for a sandwich and a beer? Yes, I used the Zone Slush Fund to better the living standards of the men of Team 50, but was that any worse than the midnight raids we'd made at Manhattan Beach and Fort Mac on nearby civilian construction sites in order to steal the necessary materials to build decent squad rooms for the men? And without our slush fund in the zone, was there any chance the Viets living next to Team 50 would have had decent quarters or a school? Yes, I gambled with senior NCOs on the team, another lead the IG was following up. But at Team 50, where fewer than 200 advisors of all ranks, though mostly sergeant and above, were thrown together in a small compound in a combat zone in the middle of the Mekong Delta, was it really necessary to follow strict army protocol? And besides,
If you got down to brass tacks, according to Army regulation, gambling of any kind was prohibited on any U.S. government-owned or leased property anywhere, which would have sent about half the brass in the U.S. Army, including Commus Mac V. Abrams, to jail. Yes, I had a steam bath, which Drac knew all about, that doubled as a whorehouse, but if the guys were going to get laid anyway, wasn't it in everyone's best interests to make sure the women were syphilis-free? As it happened, I also had a heroin amnesty program in the zone, the Army's solution to the only recently acknowledged smack problem among the ranks was to make everyone piss into a bottle during out-processing, single out the addicts, and throw them into the clanger to be court-martialed. The zone program allowed hooked guys to be brought down and weaned off the stuff under the supervision of zone doc Joseph McCauley with the help of an assigned buddy on the team. Not only did the buddy help the addict during bad times as he came down, but he also did the honors in Saigon when it came to the now ex-addict's DROS and piss test. The problem was that since heroin stayed in the system for a long time, even after a guy was off the stuff, he could still be found out in Saigon. So we solved this by having both buddy and ex-addict piss in the bottles at the overcrowded depot and then just exchange bottles. The buddy would then disappear with the smoking gun. The ex-addict would come out clean, go home, and hopefully start a better life. The real question was, did discipline on Team 50 break down as a result of these command irregularities? No. Did the IG inspection in April uncover gross inadequacies in the running and maintenance of the team? No, just the contrary. Did morale improve with the implementation of these irregular activities? No one could deny it. Did Generals McCown or Cushman come down to see me after these irregularities had been institutionalized, full of praise for the morale of Team 50 and the good work we were accomplishing with the Vietnamese? Yes, on a regular basis, and my end-of-tour ER reflected it. And through it all, did I keep my guys alive? With one tragic exception, yes. So what was the problem? The problem was twofold. One, that they, the Army's top brass, intended to get Hackworth at all costs. The other was a little matter of $12,000 worth of poker winnings that I'd left in Vietnam for some members of my team to send home for me, but which, instead, the CID intercepted. Still, Brendan Sullivan, Califano's assistant, whom the latter turned me over to after our first meeting to prepare the case, said if we went to court, I'd win. In most instances, my crimes were routine, and we would just have to bring in witnesses to establish this fact and prove I was being singled out for special treatment. In others, like the marijuana smoking, without the joint as material evidence, there was no case at all. And in the case of the money, the discovery had only added new zest to the investigation into my affairs, and the IG and CID's repeated violations of the First Amendment in their enthusiasm to nail me for violating currency regulations totally compromised any case the Army may have had. By all means, the currency-related allegations were the most serious made against me, and in hindsight, why I didn't just go into Saigon from time to time, get traveler's checks or money orders, and send them home myself rather than have my men do it for me is something that defies explanation. Unfortunately, a lot of people were hurt when the IG and CID moved in, and in the end, for me, the whole business was unquestionably the black spot in a very honorable, Hackworth honorable, career. But, Sullivan explained, even if I won, I'd lose, because of the incredibly high cost of my defense. To afford Califano services if the thing went to court could require bucks in six figures. I thought he had a case, something worthwhile that needed saying, but I don't think it had nearly the impact he would have liked it to have had, because the Army couldn't get it swept under the rug fast enough. First, one of the most decorated colonels in the Army, a future general, a superstar, turns renegade. Then he turns around and blows the whistles on the powers that be. So for the Army, it was a double embarrassment. They couldn't get it hushed up fast enough. Colonel Benjamin L. Willis, United States Army, retired. Company Commander, Alpha 1st of the 327th, 1966. G3 Advisor, 44th STZ, Republic of Vietnam, 1971. Undoubtedly, the case would be a long, hard one to prosecute, Although the Washington Post and the Christian Science Monitor have at least some of the details, they have agreed not to run the story. As far as the media are concerned, for the present at least, the Hackworth case is a dead issue. Memo for record, Office of the Chief of Staff, 28 September 1971. A buck general once told me he had the job at the Pentagon to collect information on Hack. He said he had file cabinets full of stories of improprieties and allegations of wrongdoing. One night he told me Hack was into drug dealing, and I said, "No way. You can tell me that the guy ran a poker game, and you can tell me he stole some booze for the troops, but you're not going to tell me he was buying and selling drugs on the international market." I've heard other rumors from other people, and I've always said I don't want to hear it. It won't make any difference in my life tomorrow except how I feel about the guy. But I don't want any of that to be diminished, because if it is, so many other people and so many things are also diminished. It won't do me any good to know that he is any less of a guy than I thought he was. I spent too long working too hard, being too scared for him because I believed in him, not to believe in him now. Lieutenant Colonel Dennis Foley, United States Army retired, platoon leader, 1st of the 327th Tigers, 1966, company commander, Delta 4th of the 39th, Republic of Vietnam, 1969. I've heard he was into dope. I've heard he was running guns. There's been a lot of innuendo, I suspect half-truth and falsehood, that has maligned his integrity, but I have never listened. I didn't want to listen. It's like, I don't want my vision ever, ever spoiled because I don't know whether I could live with it. It's like your old girlfriend. You want to remember how she looked 20 years ago when she had that buxom figure and that pretty long hair. You don't want to see her now because in your mind's eye, she's forever young. It has been said that David Hackworth died in the service of his country in 1971. Brigadier General John Howard, United States Army. Platoon leader, 1st of the 327th Tigers, Republic of Vietnam, 1965-66. While I knew the uproar my sounding off had caused in the zone, it was not for many years that I discovered the full extent of the furor it caused in the Pentagon. The top Army generals from Westmoreland on down launched a mammoth damage control mission from the day the first article appeared. The White House, Congress, and the media wanted the Army's answers to what I had to say. Many a Pentagon staff officer was kept up nights justifying facts and figures to make sure every single point I made could be countered on everything from the success of Vietnamization to the precise number of jeeps in the South Vietnamese Army. The readers of the Chief of Staff's weekly summary, that is, all general officers in the U.S. Army, were told that my comments reflected a lack of understanding about the tactics and strategy employed in Arvin, Republic of Vietnam, as well as the implemented improvements being made in the Army to enhance leadership and professionalism. While a related memo stated that Chief of Staff Westmoreland did not intend for the Army to engage in a debate with Colonel Hackworth in the news media, he did order a comprehensive in-house program be developed through the Army's Command Information Program to let Army personnel in on these purportedly implemented leadership and professionalism-enhancing improvements. Such a program will have the effect of countering the Hackworth statements, although not specifically designed to do so, the memo explained. The Hackworth case generated dozens of letters, memoranda, cables, and long meetings among the top brass of the Army. No top official in the Pentagon asked or sought to determine if my comments had any substance. The main thrust of the frenzied activity was first, to discredit me, and second, to determine what action could be taken to punish me for breaking the sacred taboo and speaking outside the fold. The in-house discrediting took the form of such things as the Chief of Staff's weekly summary. It was easy to say I didn't understand the tactics of the war and just ignore the Vietnam primer, whose very existence belied the statement. It was easy to criticize me by saying I did not understand the strategy of the war, because what general reading that statement would admit he didn't understand it himself? Only 3 years later would a survey reveal that of the Army generals who had managed the war in Vietnam, almost 70% were uncertain of its objectives. My public discrediting, tit for tat, was left to the Army's chief apologist, Slam Marshall. Though he had not spoken with or laid eyes on me in 3 years, Slam wrote with great authority in his syndicated newspaper column that I was battle-rattled. When a man has been overlong in battle, and that is Hackworth, damned me with faint praise, I found him to be fairly steady and always companionable, brilliant on occasional flashes, tending to be resentful of association with higher authority, otherwise generous of spirit, and then lied through his teeth to imply I was a coward. 1 year later, we tried the same thing again, at his request, but he simply vanished. One reader who immediately got Slam's number was one Helen Lord McNiven of San Pedro, California. Mrs. McNiven wrote to Slam in an open letter, "May I suggest to you, sir, that your column was designed to belittle, denigrate, and demean a colonel of the United States Army who has already proven himself to be a capable, forthright, and courageous man, and that your petty sniping and carpings are those of an old man who has a dirty hatchet job to do." Chief of Staff Westmoreland was very much involved with the Hackworth case, even obsessively so. In the earliest days, he was just puzzled, calling in men who knew me, like John Hayes, to ask why I'd spoken out, particularly because he'd felt sure, so he told Hayes, that I was going to be one of the next brigadier generals. According to Jack Woodmansey, who was called to his meeting with the chief while Westy was getting his hair cut, the general felt personally betrayed by my performance, declaring that I wouldn't have done it if I were a good soldier. Woodmansey told him that I made a great contribution to the 44th Zone, which apparently calmed the chief down a bit. But then MACVIG began sending word back from Saigon of its Team 50 discoveries, and then Westy got mad. The inevitable general from South Carolina, who as Commus MACV had ordered his staff to submit doctored reports on enemy strength in Vietnam to keep the politicians on board his victory-bound war train, or so it was proved 15 years later, still unsullied as chief, was determined I be punished out of his concern for the Army's professional standards and ethics and the long-range impact on the integrity of the Army if no action of any kind were taken. And even after he was informed by no less than Robert F. Froelke, the new Secretary of the Army, that the investigation was not going to uncover evidence of serious criminal misconduct on my part, Westmoreland was determined that the case remain open. He made sure the Internal Revenue Service was apprised of the situation and a commitment made by that organization to pursue me outside Army channels. He strongly urged the Secretary of the Army to sign a shattering letter of censure to go into my permanent file. In the end, he had less luck with the Secretary than he did with the IRS. While I did get a 7-year tax audit, which uncovered nothing, as there was nothing to uncover, not only did I not receive a letter of censure for my permanent file, but any other Get Hackworth plans on Westy's part were nipped in the bud on the very day I was to get out. As Secretary of the Army Froelke wrote in his close-hold memo for record on the subject, "During the course of an investigation instituted by certain allegations made by Colonel David H. Hackworth, testimony was received which indicated possible serious shortcomings in his personal conduct. This investigation of Colonel Hackworth's personal conduct is not completed. Nevertheless, I am directing that the investigation be closed and retiring him as of this date. My decision is based on advice of the General Counsel that significant evidence of serious criminal misconduct is unlikely to be developed by the ongoing investigation. Of equal importance is the consideration I gave to Colonel Hackworth's magnificent combat record, lengthy service in Vietnam, and multiple wounds, awards, and decorations." I, of course, knew nothing of all this, as day after day I sweated out word that I would be allowed to retire. So when it was over, I could hardly believe my ears. On Tuesday, 28 September 1971, at 1900 hours, Joe Califano called. "Report to Fort Meade on Thursday," he said, "for your discharge." As he went on to explain how he'd persuaded the Secretary of the Army to let the case drop, and how the Secretary had given the hard word to Westmoreland, who'd had to give in, I barely comprehended the words. I was too stunned. 2 days later, I reported to the Adjutant General section at Fort Meade. An old, very sympathetic colonel named Webb out-processed me. It was quite a formal procedure, in which I had to sign papers, collect back pay, and close out this part of my life forever. In the middle of it, Webb received a phone call. He was sitting at his desk when he took it, but when the caller identified himself, the colonel, a real Southern gentleman type, leaped to his feet.
"Yes, sir," he said with the utmost urgency, and stood at attention as the conversation continued, his side of which went something like, "Yes, sir." "No, sir." "No, sir, he hasn't." Which I read as, "Yes, sir, he's here. No, sir, he hasn't left. No, sir, he hasn't signed out." "Very well, sir." Webb wound up the call, and I did a quick scope of the area to see how I was going to bust out. In my mind, the colonel had been told, "Don't let him go. We're arresting him, and he's going to jail." But I wasn't going to jail. No way were they going to get me, not after all this. The colonel got off the phone. "That was General Westmoreland," he said. He might have said that was General Westmoreland's office, but I wasn't sure. I wasn't receiving too well. My heart was pounding too loud and too fast. The colonel started looking through the pile of documents and certificates that made up my discharge papers. He extracted one and showed it to me. It was a certificate signed by Westmoreland thanking me, Colonel David H. Hackworth, for my 25 years of honorable and dedicated service to the Army. The personalized certificate, a gimmick instituted by Westmoreland when he became chief of staff, was an automatic issue for guys who retired while Westy held the top job. "But the general doesn't want you to have this," Colonel Webb explained, and deep-sixed it on the spot. And I thought, here is the chief of staff of the Army, running an organization of almost 2 million men, with troops all over the world and a war being lost in South Vietnam, and he has the time, he makes the time, to call or direct someone to call the AG at Fort Meade to make sure I, David Hackworth, didn't think he was glad I'd been on his team. As the troops used to say, so it goes.
Epilogue. A few days after the Newsweek article with Hack's interview when it hit the streets of Saigon, I got a call from MacV informing me that my request for an interview with General Abrams had been approved. I thought that it was a bit odd, since I had put in the request 6 months earlier with no results. When I sat down with him, he told me that in exchange for the interview, he wanted a favor. He wanted to talk about Hackworth. I agreed, and he asked me about Hack's mood during our interview. Anything else he had said that didn't get into the piece. How deep his bitterness with the Army ran. Questions of that sort. When I told him what I knew, he said in a sad voice, "Colonel Hackworth is the best battalion commander I ever saw in the United States Army. We cannot afford to lose men of his caliber. If it continues, the damage to the Army will be irreparable." Nick Prophet, Newsweek correspondent, Republic of Vietnam, July 1971. Almost 18 years have passed since I hung up my soldier suit. If I was left with a handful of ashes at the end of my Army career, I was also left with a heart full of memories. Profound, wonderful memories that more than offset the ones I would have preferred to forget. I have brothers all around the globe. Comrades in arms for whom distance and time have meant nothing in terms of the love and friendship we share to this day, forged in conditions I pray our sons and grandsons never have to experience themselves. Judge Tom Cooney was probably right when he suggested that I could have had a greater impact on military reform and preparedness had I stayed in the Army rather than standing outside it and criticizing. On the other hand, fine warriors like Hank Emerson and Hal Moore, who did stay in and fought from the inside, were both turfed out as 3 stars by the clerks at the top when they still had plenty more to offer. Emerson, for criticizing the priorities of the Army's weapons procurement system, and Moore, for taking issue with having women in the combat arms and in certain engineer and artillery jobs with high combat vulnerability, as well as for opposing the Army's lowering of recruiting standards, IQ and education, to meet recruitment goals. Many other talented warriors lost the day in similar circumstances. No doubt had I stayed in, a similar fate would have been mine.
but having been thrown out for them did not make Emerson's or Moore's or other fine warriors' criticisms then or now any less valid, and similarly, my decision to get out when I did, even my journey part way around the bend in my last command, though some may argue the point, does not invalidate my own present-day observations, concerns, and suggestions for the future of the Army, an institution I loved for too long not to still love above almost all else. Though I am no longer in the Army, and for so many years have not lived in the United States, my continued and very real desire to serve both, if I possibly can, was the basic reason for this book and for the pages that follow. As I go on, it will be difficult to discuss what have become very political issues in an apolitical way, very difficult to tread the thin line between left and right. If my own politics show through as being slightly left of center, it would not be unfair to ask that it be remembered they were once far to the right of John Birch. If my warts and all description of my last command, which in the manuscript stage made a number of good friends cringe and beg me to be a little less forthcoming, offends, or in some minds calls my credibility into question, may I say that to tell all was a choice I made. I did not believe I had a right to discuss what happened to my army if I did not honestly discuss what happened to me as well. And if it appears odd that a self-professed warrior is now pushing the line for peace, or at least a better way to resolve conflict. In fact, I am only joining the ranks of MacArthur, Montgomery, Mountbatten, and scores of other retired soldiers who, with no vested interest in the industry of war, and with plenty of time to put their feet up and think, recognize that the stakes of war have grown too high to be a viable problem solver. But first, soon after I was allowed to retire, Jenny and I moved to Spain. I planned to write an exposé of the Army, but as the input began rolling in from friends both in uniform or retired and those who had quit in disillusionment, the words of Stanley Rezor during our last chance encounter kept running through my mind. I'd just gotten out of the Army. I'd been walking down the street in Washington looking distinctly unmilitary in jeans and a t-shirt, sandals, and a three-day beard when I saw him standing in front of the Brookings Institute. Deciding the best course of action was to escape and evade, I picked up the pace, looked the other way, and prayed this fine man wouldn't recognize me. But he did, and 25 years of military conditioning compelled me to snap a correct, "Yes, sir," rather than keep walking when he tentatively called my name. The former Secretary of the Army had heard all about my difficulties, but he was sympathetic, not critical, and told me he was sorry it had ended this way. Rezor asked what I planned to do, and when I said I was going to write a book, he said, "Make sure it's constructive, and not just another vindictive attack on a system already suffering mighty blows. Think it out. You could make a great contribution." I rogered the transmission as a sedan pulled up, which, after shaking my hand, Rezor got into and was driven away. Even so, I still had every intention of proceeding with my project. Once settled in Spain, however, I realized that Rezor was right, that whatever I would write would be angry, bitter, vindictive, and ultimately valueless. That belief was reinforced with the news that John Paul Vann's chopper had gone down in the highlands of Vietnam, and that renegade soldier, the first to stand in the door over the U.S. conduct of the war in the early 60s, who retired from the Army but could not turn his back on South Vietnam and returned as a civilian to do what he could, had been killed. Radio Hanoi took credit for the death of Vann, by then the senior advisor of Two Corps, a two-star general's billet, and unquestionably the most knowledgeable American on the war ever to serve in Vietnam. While Vann, not unlike Bernard Fall, had been rolling the dice for so long that his fate seemed almost inevitable, the death of this old friend knocked me to my knees. Jenny continued to be a tremendous source of strength throughout this period, but the pressure that had been building from the moment I'd decided to speak out was not easily dissipated, and it took a tremendous toll on our relationship. We tried to recapture the early magic on a leisurely drive around Europe, but it proved impossible. Within a year, we parted, though at least as friends. I migrated to Australia, the farthest place from the United States I could find and still speak English, with little money, the wrong accent, and no obviously transferable skills from the life I'd left behind. I concluded that the only two things I knew anything about were mess halls and motor pools. So, over the first couple of years in Australia, I dabbled in both, owning a diner and a couple of gas station garages in Queensland's fast-growing Gold Coast. All were very successful, great money spinners that kept me too busy to feel sorry for myself. But I got tired of the life and sold it all to buy a 160-acre property in the lush rainforests of northern New South Wales. There, I entered my hippie phase, and with a special woman named Christine Hudson as my guiding spirit, was finally able to work the war out of my system and wash most of the pain away. I wrote occasional articles for American and Australian publications, and in April of 75 watched with no satisfaction as my prediction of 4 years before came true when the North Vietnamese flag was hoisted to fly triumphantly over Saigon. 2 years later, through John Rowe, a former Australian Army major who'd been with the 1st RAR during my first of the 101st days, I met Peter Margaret Cox. Peter was a longtime Brisbane restaurateur, and her establishment at that time, Scaramouche, was the in spot in Brisbane. The place was also being hounded by creditors and on the verge of going broke. Its owner had incredible flair, but absolutely no business sense. It didn't take much to see that the restaurant had everything going for it except organization. And when Peter asked for a hand, I found it a challenge I couldn't resist. Once I got my SOPs in place, business began to boom. Within a few years, the permanent staff of Scaramouche had grown from 10 to 80 people, and the weekly gross from $2,000 to $50,000. 5 years after I walked in the door and started paying the bills I'd found stuffed and long forgotten in the backs of drawers, Peter and I walked out after selling the place for $1 million. We were also married at this point, and the proud parents of my fourth child, Ben, whom I prayed I'd be a better father to than I had been all those years to Laura, Leslie, and Joel. The time was 1981, the first year of the Reagan administration. If I'd thought the sale of Scaramouche would be the beginning of a life of leisure for me, it was a thought soon wiped from my mind as the new rumblings in Washington filled me with alarm I hadn't felt since the height of the Vietnam War. The new president had surrounded himself with Nuke the Pukers, for whom the concept of nuclear war between the U.S. and the Soviet Union was not only imaginable, but inevitable. Who talked about U.S. losses being kept at a compatible level of 20 million dead, who said nuclear war would be a terrible mess, but it would not be unmanageable. Like an amputation, traumatic, but not necessarily fatal. I was stunned. These men, most of them academics who had never been on a battlefield, and many of whom, it would later be discovered, had actively avoided service in Vietnam, who wouldn't have had the slightest idea about death, dying, destruction, and the wholesale suffering attendant on even conventional war, were talking about, conceivably, the end of life on Earth as we know it, as if it were a backlot baseball game. The more I read about what was happening in Washington, the more concerned I became. It seemed like Vietnam all over again, only the stakes were infinitely higher and the key players understood the game even less. We had killed tens of thousands of people in Southeast Asia to save the region from the communists. Was the new administration ready to kill most of humankind to save the West from the same ubiquitous boogeyman? From Australia, it seemed as if Reagan's window of vulnerability had been opened solely to blow in bitter winds that could fuel the Cold War and whip up national anti-Soviet hysteria. Only after the American people were sufficiently scared would they permit the $1.5 trillion expenditure the administration deemed necessary to establish and maintain its noble peace through strength. I decided to stick my head in the sand. I figured in Australia my family was moderately safe, though to hedge my bets I did begin to dig in at my farm, stockpiling food and water just in case an accident, a miscalculation, or the act of a mad zealot brought forth the first salvo of World War III, and I might have played ostrich for the rest of my life but for a telephone conversation with my daughter Leslie and a visit to my farm by the Hardcore's Night Hunter 6, Larry Toller. Leslie at that time was in choppers in the U.S. Coast Guard. We were talking about radioactive fallout and life in general after a Soviet-U.S. nuclear exchange, and she just laughed it off with, "I don't worry about that, Dad. It'll be over in a few seconds. We'll be fried, and that's it." I was amazed. It had never occurred to me that my daughter took it for granted that one day she'd be vaporized. I was yet to know that that was the price she and her generation paid for being born under the sign of the bomb. When Larry Toller came to Australia, he told me I had no right to bury my head in the sand. If I believed the nuclear party line coming out of government and military circles in Washington was insane, he said, then as a natural leader and a soldier with my credentials, I was obliged to speak out. His argument was compelling. The only problem was that I didn't have enough facts to stand upright on my soapbox. Thus began long months of study followed by 3 years as an active participant in the nuclear debate in Australia. My goal was to educate, to use my knowledge and credentials as a warrior to persuade the Australian people, from members of parliament to the average man and woman on the street, to also become active participants in the debate, to add their voices to those around the globe protesting the absurd concept of a winnable nuclear war, as well as the stockpiling of nuclear weapons, which, rather than adding to the defense of the Western world, only destabilized it. After 3 years of radio, television, and public speaking engagements on the subject, when I felt I'd said everything I could possibly say to everyone I could possibly imagine finding to say it to, twice, I put my soapbox away. And I had the satisfaction of knowing I'd helped illumine a nation to the most critical issue humankind has faced to this day. Which brings us to the present. Besides relating a life story in these pages, I've tried to portray what I saw with my eyes of what happened to the U.S. Army through two unwinnable wars, themselves fought under the omnipresent umbrella of the unwinnable war, the Cold War. That war is now discussed and or recognized in many circles as being over, not through winning or losing or either side changing its global objectives, but through the superpowers acknowledging that they have all but spent themselves broke preparing to fight it, is something to be heralded as a step in the right direction for global stability and East-West economic reconstruction. It does not mean, however, that war is over and will never be fought again, or that either superpower has suddenly been exempted from examining its past performances. While the need for such scrutiny should be self-evident, historically the U.S. military, as quickly and efficiently as humanly possible, sweeps under the rug the reality of its less sterling accomplishments, and there is little evidence to suggest there will be any change now. It is, of course, impossible for me to conjecture when or how the Soviet military will treat its debacle in Afghanistan. Korea, for example, did not become the Forgotten War, as Clay Blair's fine book on the subject is titled, by accident. The absence of a glorious victory in this pre-television war is no doubt a main factor in the American public's vague recall of the event today. In that generation, however, that absence of victory was tantamount to defeat, unthinkable in the wake of World War II and the trouncing of Germany and Japan, and the first seeds of national self-doubt took root. In the military, the Korea result was even more profound. Never had American arms performed so badly in a time of war as the American military did in the first months of the Korean conflict. Clay Blair's book catalogs the remarkable failings in training, logistics, support, and leadership. Men arrived in Korea in the summer of 1950 who had never fired their weapons. M-24 tanks whose 75mm guns had not been fired because their units hadn't received the recoil oil they'd had on order for 2 years led to the tanks' turrets being blown off the vehicles when the guns were fired for the first time. Battalion, regiment, and division commanders arrived too old for the job, whose inappropriate tactics led to the misuse and sacrifice, often in sheer bloodbaths, of the green garrison units at their disposal. The senior brass were so humiliated by their overall ineptitude in the early prosecution of the war, and then the stagnation of the later phases, that the minute the war was over, they hid the truth away, even from themselves. The result was the military learned nothing from the Korean experience, only to carry the same non-lessons into the next war to blow it all over again. And Vietnam was all the more humiliating for being exposed on the 6 o'clock news every night. But when that war was over, while the first instinct on the part of the generals who managed it was to file it, like Korea, under O for oblivion, instead, over the last few years, it has become clear that another tack has been taken. Now, the war managers are working overtime to rewrite the truth of what happened in that war. A score of years later, retired three-star General Robert Schweitzer's suggestion, made as a light colonel in 1968, that the Army must lead the way in conducting a PSYOPs campaign, that American arms accomplished their mission in Vietnam, has become an unwritten but vigorously maintained policy. The major treatise on the American Army's failings in Vietnam is a book titled On Strategy by retired Colonel Harry Summers, Jr. On Strategy is an important work, correctly analyzing many of the major mistakes and lessons learned from the Vietnam War. The book's basic